And welcome back to A Twist of Fate. This week's episode, we are talking about the murder of James Bulger. James Patrick Bulger was a 2-year-old little boy from Kirkby, Merseyside, England. He had been abducted, tortured, then murdered by Robert Thompson and John Venables. Both were only 10 years old at the time. On February 12, 1993, the boys had led James away from the New Strand shopping center in Bootle when his mother had turned away from him for just a second. The boys had been at the shopping center, skipping school and stealing things that would later be found at the crime scene. One of the boys later admitted that they were going to lure a child to a busy road and push him into traffic. The moment that the boys took James was caught on security cameras. They took him to the Leeds and Liverpool canal where they dropped him on his head. During that 2.5-mile walk from the shopping center, the three boys were seen by 38 people, and only two confronted them. When they were confronted, John and Robert claimed that James was their brother or that he was lost, and they were showing him to the police station. At some point in their walk, they stopped at a pet store and had gotten kicked out. James's torture began at the abandoned Walton and Ainfield railway station that was across the street and up a hill from the Walton Lane police station. It started by one of the boys flicking blue paint in his eye. The 10-year-old proceeded to kick him, stomp on him, and throw bricks and stones at him. They ended their torture by dropping a 22-pound iron bar on him. James has sustained 10 skull fractures just from the iron bar alone. The pathologist that worked on the case said that James suffered a total of 42 injuries, and none of them could be isolated as the fatal blow. As an attempt to look like a train accident, the boys laid his body across the train tracks, hoping a train would hit him, and it would just be classified as an accident. When they had left, a train did come through and split the little boy's body in half. On Valentine's Day, two boys walking the tracks found the 2-year-old's body. The forensic pathologist testified that James had died before being hit by the train. Officers had suspected that there was a sexual element behind the crime since James's pants, underwear, and socks had been taken off. They had done insanely awful things to this child. When they had been interviewed by Eileen Vizard, a child psychiatrist, and by detectives, they were reluctant to give any details. At John's future parole hearing, his psychiatrist, Susan Bailey, stated, "Visiting and revisiting the issue with John as a child and now as an adolescent, he gives no account of any sexual element to the events." Officers quickly obtained the security footage of the two unidentified boys leading the 2-year-old out of the shopping center. One boy who had been questioned by police had to leave town because of the threats he had been getting. Not long after, a girl came forward who told officers that she used to skip class with John and she knew that he had skipped with Robert that day. That's when the boys were arrested. It was a shock to pretty much everyone that 2 10-year-olds could have done something this horrific. Forensic tests confirmed that the blue paint on John and Robert's clothes was the same blue paint found on James. The blood on their shoes was a match to the 2-year-olds. It is said that Robert had asked an officer if James had been taken to the hospital to, quote, get him alive again. They were both charged with murder on February 20th, 1993, and the trial started 2 days later. In the media, the boys were referred to as Child A and Child B. Up to 500 protesters showed up outside of the South Sefton Magistrates Court during the trial. The boys' parents had been moved to different parts of the country and had been given new identities due to the death threats they had been getting from vigilantes. Both boys were tried as adults when the full trial started on November 1st, 1993. They both pleaded not guilty to the charges of attempted abduction, and murder. The attempted abduction charge had happened on February 12th, before James had been killed. The boys had tried to lure a different 2-year-old boy away, however, they were stopped by the boys' mother. In court, the boys sat in raised chairs so that they could see out of the dock that had been designed for adults, with two social workers next to them. Even though they were kept separate from their parents, when they would attend the trial, they sat near the boys. The fact the trial was open to the media later had been criticized by the European Court of Human Rights, which had ruled in 1999 that the boys had not received a fair trial. During the trial, the prosecution counsel, Richard Henriques, successfully refuted the principle of doli in capax, which presumed that young children could not be held legally responsible for their actions. When Eileen Vizard, the child psychiatrist who had interviewed Robert before the trial, was questioned if he knew the difference between right and wrong, wrong to take a child from his mother, or that it's wrong to hurt another kid. Vizard answered, "If the issue is on the balance of probabilities, I think I can answer with certainty," adding that he was suffering from PTSD. The child psychiatrist, Susan Bailey, who interviewed John, had agreed that he also knew the difference from right and wrong. Robert and John did not speak during the trial. The case was being based on over 20 hours of the recorded interviews with the boys. Robert was considered as the more dominant one and took the lead in the kidnapping process, though it was John's idea to take him to the railroad. Lawrence Lee, the man watching over Robert during the trial, had stated that Robert was one of the most terrifying kids he had met, comparing him to the Pied Piper. James's underwear, a box of 27 bricks, a bloodstained stone, and the rusty iron bar had all been presented by the prosecution. The pathologist spent 33 minutes in court going over James's injuries, many being on his legs after his pants had been taken off. The brain damage James had suffered was extensive and caused a hemorrhage. Robert and John were found guilty of 2-year-old James's murder on November 24th. Becoming the youngest convicted murderers in the 20th century. The judge, Mr. Justice Moreland, told Robert and John that they had committed a crime of, quote, unparalleled evil and barbarity. In my judgment, your conduct was both cunning and very wicked, sentencing them to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, with the recommendation they serve a minimum of 8 years. Before the trial ended, the judge lifted the restrictions, now allowing the media to publish the boys' names and ages. His statement on why was, "I did this because the public interest overrode the interest of the defendants. There was a need for an informed public debate on crimes committed by young children." The editors of the Sun newspaper handed Home Secretary Michael Howard a petition to increase the boys' time that had almost 280,000 signatures. In July of 1994, Howard made the announcement that Robert and John would be sentenced to a minimum of 15 years, meaning that they would be released in February of 2008 and would be 25 years old. However, it was overturned by the House of Lords in 1997. Ruling that it was unlawful for the Home Secretary to decide a minimum sentence for young offenders. The High Court and European Court of Human Rights have since ruled, though Parliament can set minimum and maximum sentences for individual categories of crime, it is ultimately the trial judge's responsibility, with the benefit of all evidence and arguments from both the prosecution and defense to determine the minimum term in individual cases. Robert Thompson was held at the Barton Moss Secure Care Center in Manchester, and John had been held in Vardy House, a small unit at Red Bank Secure Unit in St. Helens. Where they had been held was kept secret until after they had been released. Everything the boys did was recorded twice daily on running sheets, and then signed by the staff member who wrote it. John and Robert were taught to keep what they did in their names, their real names, a secret. Both of the boys' parents had regularly visited their sons in their separate facilities. Both were suffering from PTSD. John's was so bad he would have nightmares and flashbacks of the murder. In 1999, Robert and John's lawyers appealed to the European Court of Human Rights that their trial was not impartial, since they were too young to understand an adult court or even to follow proceedings. Their inhumane trial claim had been dismissed. However, the court upheld their claim that the boys were denied a fair hearing by the nature of the court proceeding. They had also upheld that Michael Howard interfering in the case led to a highly charged atmosphere, which then resulted in an unfair judgment. In June of 2001, after a six-month review, Robert and John were ruled no longer a threat to the public and could be released since their minimum sentence had been up in February earlier that year. David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, approved their decision, and the boys were released a few weeks later after 8 years. Both of the boys were placed in witness protection program and were given new names and were moved to secret locations. They had been given fake passports, national insurance numbers, qualification certificates, and medical records. Blunkett had added to their license by insisting that he be sent daily updates on what they were up to. The terms of their release were: they weren't allowed to contact each other or James's family. They could not return to Merseyside. Curfews could be imposed on them. And that they had to report to their probation officers. If they broke any of these rules or were deemed a risk to the public again, they could be put back in prison. An injunction was forced on the media that their new identities and locations could not be released. In 2001, Blunkett stated the injunction was granted because there was a real and strong possibility that their lives would be at risk if their identities became known. The Observer reported how James's family's lawyers had consulted with psychiatrists to present their parole board with a report that Robert was an undiagnosed psychopath, noting his lack of remorse during arrest or during the trial. However, the report was dismissed. After they were released, they had dropped their Liverpool accents. In another report published in 2000, before John was released, he was deemed a trivial risk to the public and was unlikely to offend again. The Manchester Evening News had published a report that suggested where the boys could have been staying, which was in breach of the injunction, which had just been renewed in 2001. In December, the paper had been fined £30,000 for contempt of court and were also ordered to pay a total of £120,000. Even though there was the condition of no contact between families in 2004, James's mother had gotten a message from an anonymous person telling her where Robert was living. However, when she saw him, she said that she was filled with hatred and couldn't confront him. Before John was released in 2001, at 17 years old, he had apparently had sex with a woman who had been working at the Red Bank Secure Unit. In April of 2011, after John had been arrested again in 2010, David James Smith had published these allegations in the Sunday Times magazine. Smith had been following the case since the first trial in 1993. That female staff member had been accused of sexual misconduct and was ultimately suspended. She would never go back. A spokesman for the St. Helens Borough Council denied that that's what happened, and denied that it was a cover-up. They said all allegations were thoroughly investigated by an independent team on the orders of the Home Office and chaired by the author Dave Frischling, a retired prison governor. At some point in 2002, John had started dating a lady with a 5-year-old son. It's unknown if he started downloading child porn before or after he started living with them. However, he claims that he never even met the 5-year-old. In 2005, 23-year-old James introduced his 17-year-old girlfriend to his probation officer. After a while without supervision, John started to excessively drink, do drugs, download child abuse images, and even had gone to Merseyside. He was arrested in September of 2008 on suspicion of a fray after he had gotten into a fight outside of a nightclub. He had claimed self-defense, and later the charges were dropped because he had promised to go to AA. Only 3 months later, he was found with cocaine on him and was given a curfew. John had also gone and revealed to 2 separate people who he actually was. On March 2, 2010, the Ministry of Justice revealed that John had gone back to prison for another violation of his license of release. The Justice Secretary, Jack Straw, stated that he had gone back to prison because of extremely serious allegations and stated that he was unable to give further details of the reason for John Venables' return to custody because it was not in the public interest to do so. On March 7th, the media came out with reports that John had been sent back to jail because he was accused of obtaining child pornography. The judge that had granted John anonymity in 2001 warned that he would be killed if his real identity was revealed. On May 4th, 2011, someone had reported that John was once again given a new identity after what was said to be a serious security breach. Some had released his identity before he had gone back to prison in 2010. However, the full details couldn't be released for legal reasons. Sometime in June of 2019, British officials were considering moving John to either Canada or Australia or New Zealand because it was getting so expensive to keep giving him a new identity. They had spent £65,000 in legal fees just to keep John anonymous. In response to the media broadcasting the decisions being considered, the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, replied that John would need an exemption under the Immigration Act and that he shouldn't bother applying. This has been A Twist of Fate. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, if you have any questions or requests, feel free to message me. Have a great day.